We're going to be starting in the book of Hebrews, the 11th chapter. We're glad that you're here, and we hope and trust that our time spent together will be profitable. Some folks you know, and some folks you don't know. And I'm getting to try to figure out Chris. You got to watch out for those quiet ones. He came up and asked me tonight, "Are you ready?" And I said, "Well, I'm late." And he said, "Okay." I said, "How much time do I have?" He said, "How much do you want?" We both knew that was a silly question. But then he looked at me and he said, "Well, the adult class will last an hour and a half." And what I wanted to say to him was, "You're not scaring me." But right away I could tell he was joking. Sit tight. We're going to be here for about 2 hours. We're going to start in the book of Hebrews, the 11th chapter. What we're going to be looking at over the next 3 nights, tonight, tomorrow night, Wednesday night, is what we would commonly call a type that's mentioned in the old law, and the fulfillment of that type with a better type, if you will, in the new law that supersedes that initial type that you looked at, that you got used to understanding what that was, and now you see it more clearly in the new law. So we're going to be looking at Moses and Jesus. And that may seem to be odd bedfellows at first, but you're going to find out how much they have in common. And what we're going to be looking at tonight is Moses as a prince and what that entails in the New Testament. Now, I think that what we're going to find is probably the next 2 nights we're going to have a closer analogy with Moses and Jesus. And we'll explain that a little further as we go along. But we're going to start in Hebrews 11, and we're going to begin in verse 24. "By faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Considering the reproach of Christ greater than riches and treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen." Now, this passage in Hebrews 11 is in that chapter that's called by many the chapter of faith. And we looked at faith a little bit yesterday in starting to gather some thoughts about what we're going to be looking at. But you see some of the phrases in Hebrews 11. You see the phrase that he was looking to the reward, that faith has substance. You look at him seeing him who is unseen, and how that the testimony of others gives credence to our faith, even though we've never seen him. So in this text, we're looking at some of those things that speak about Moses. And as we look at this and leave Hebrews 11 for a minute, we're going to go and spend the rest of our time probably tonight in the book of Exodus. So if you will turn to Exodus, the first chapter, we're going to look at Moses in the sense of how he got from where this all started to where he ends up really beginning to do the work that God has set before him to do. In Exodus, the first chapter, it says in verse 1, "Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. And they came each one with his own household." And so we get the picture here in words of what we're looking at as Moses is going to come onto the scene. Verse 7 said, the sons of Israel were fruitful and increasing greatly, and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt that did not know Joseph. Now, we have to go backwards a little bit before we can go forward. And we're going to go backward to the point where the children of Israel are being held in Egyptian bondage, and that's going to be very important to everything that we notice about Moses. The children of Israel in this bondage, though, are becoming a great nation, almost under the nose of the Egyptians. And as they continue to grow and grow and grow, it looks like things are going along well. But the first thing that we notice in verse 7 is there arises a king who does not know Joseph. And that can slip right by us if we're not careful. And the reason that it would slip by us is because we've got to go back even farther to find out what Joseph's place in all this was, how he had risen through the wholesale efforts of his brothers, how they had actually tried to get rid of him, first by killing him and then by selling him, and how he rises in the ranks to become second in command even to Pharaoh. And he brings his family down and he makes peace with his brothers. And now, being second in command, he is ultimately banished by Pharaoh's wife, if you will, and he goes into an exile not of his own doing. But ultimately what happens is there arises a king who does not know Joseph. And Israel's fate changes on that day. And the reason it changes on that day is because of the fact that there comes somebody that doesn't know what Joseph's done, who doesn't know the relationship that has developed, who doesn't know God's people, who doesn't understand why Israel is growing and growing and growing and nobody seems to be noticing it. And from that, he takes a totally different approach to the Israelites. And we can pause here for just a moment to look at this. When we look at it from the perspective of where we are, we go, okay, that's part of the story. But what I want you to notice from this is how quickly things can change. I was eating with the Heglers this evening, and we were talking about days gone by and preachers and how things happen in the church and how things have changed in some regards. And that seems like not that long ago. But when you start adding some of those things up, it's 20 and 30 years. What's 20 and 30 years amongst friends? Well, sometimes it means a totally different depiction of things. And when we look at this king that did not know Joseph, the lesson that we ought to learn is this. It only takes one generation for the faith to die. And that generation is the next one. You see, you're here. I don't know the reason why all of you are here, but I'm going to give you the thought process of saying you're here because you're interested in the faith. And you're here because you wanted to bring children to learn about the faith. And you want them to grow in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. But statistically speaking, you're supposed to kind of tilt your head when you say that. Statistically speaking, most churches and families exist in their faith for about four generations. And if you think about that, you have to ask yourself this question: what generation are we? And you go, well, I've just obeyed the gospel. Well, great, I got four more generations. No, really three, but excuse the math. But I can tell you about a grandfather that was an elder in the church and a father who preached, and then my generation, and now my children's. And now my grandchildren are in a sixth generation. If there's only four, by and large, they're on borrowed time. And you say, well, that's a poor way to look at it. Well, it's really a good way to look at it, because if you're always making sure the next generation is not the last generation, then you're going to be okay. But we don't think that way. We look on the tote board and there was, I don't know how many yesterday, a bunch. And we go, there was a bunch. The house looked full. The air conditioner had to work overtime. And we take great comfort in that. But it only takes one generation, one split, one disagreement, one brother that brings in false doctrine. And what took generations to come can go away very quickly because of one thing. There arose a king who knew not Joseph. And what we would call that king is ignorant. Not stupid. Not uneducated. We would call him ignorant because the most important thing that he should have known about in regard to leading his own people, he knew nothing about, and it brings about the ultimate end. Because God comes back in to bring out his people. And all that he did wrong was he didn't know about Joseph. And we assume that the next generation will be a great generation because they come from this generation. And it is not the necessitation of the fact that they won't be good people. It's just that, do you know how many different things are bombarding the hearts and the minds of men today? And how easy it is to get sidetracked. The responsibility of the elders here is to make sure this is not the last generation. The responsibility of the Christians and the preachers and the teachers here are to make sure the next generation doesn't not know God. If we do that, we won't count things in four generations. But if we don't do that, we'll talk about the generation that came that didn't know what they should have known. It's a tough way to start out. You go, well, boy, if that's the first point, it must be tough sledding. Well, in a way, it is. And in a way, the next point seems kind of anticlimactic. In the book of Exodus, the first chapter, you're going to find out that what God does is that he protects his people in a way that, I know you can't see, that should be Exodus 1:20. And that's my fault. So hopefully I'll know all the verses as we go along. This king said, we got to get rid of these Israelites, or at least we got to slow them down. So here's what we're going to do. The male children that are born, we're going to dispose of them. All the girls can live. And he gives this instruction to the midwives. And as this goes along, you think, boy, that's That's a tough job description. Your job description is to get rid of the boys and keep the girls. But look what happens in this particular passage. The king in verse 15, the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Sapphira and the others. And he says in verse 16, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it's a son, you shall put him to death. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live. Verse 17, if you have your own Bible, you ought to mark this. Well, no matter whose Bible you've got, just go ahead and mark it. They'll need it too. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous. And they give birth before the midwife can get to them. I tell you what, there's a lot of things in the scriptures. This is really quick thinking. You see, these Israel women, they're tough. Man, before we even get there, everything's done. Now, if it were the Egyptian women, yeah, we could do something because they're kind of dainty. Verse 20. God was good to the midwives, and the people became mighty, and they multiplied. You know, we still haven't got to Moses yet, but he's coming. And here's midwives that God took favor with, because they did what they could. Sometimes you hear people say, there's just nothing for me to do. You know, so-and-so does this, and somebody else does this, and there's nothing for me to do in the kingdom. I mean, what can I do? Well, when you get to feeling that way, you go back here to Exodus 1. And if a midwife who'd been told to kill all the male children can help spare the nation of Israel by just fearing God and not doing what everybody else said to do, then that's the same thing you can do. You know, the world is telling you all kinds of things that should be done and that ought to be done. And the other day, there came down a judgment from the Supreme Court on a homosexual issue, 7-2. And you went, yes, there's hope. The baker didn't have to bake the cake. This week, we found out, well, that really doesn't mean that. And the seven judges that voted for it only wanted it to get through so they could change it later. And I'm sitting listening to these commentators who are telling us that doesn't really mean anything. Don't believe that. Don't listen. Don't keep trying to do what's right. Don't even think that this is going to happen. And the king said, you kill the baby boys. And the midwife said, we will not. And so, God looked upon them with favor. You may not be able to do a lot. You may not be able to do everything you want to do. You may not be able to stand on the mountain, bring the laws down and written in stone, but you can do what you can do. You can do what God tells you to do, and that's why God favored these midwives. Well, the story keeps going on, and in Exodus 2, they find this young man who's born, and he's a beautiful child, and his mother hides him for 3 months, but this edict has been given now, you're just supposed to throw your baby in the river. And so it in verse 4, Moses' sisters, after they put him in this basket and they take him to a place, it says they put him where the daughter of Pharaoh, in verse 5, came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And when she saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her maid and she brought it to her. And when she opened it up, she saw the child. And behold, the boy was crying, and she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children." And isn't that amazing how that happened? We'll just put it here, and she'll accidentally find it. And then I'll run and ask her if she wants me to bring the mother to nurse the child. And she takes this Hebrew child, and in Exodus 20 and verse 10, he becomes her son. He lives in Pharaoh's house. He becomes a prince. He enjoys the luxuries of everything that being a prince has to do, because this time his family tried to save him. But if you will drop down to Exodus, the second chapter, in verse 11, it says, in verse 11, "Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up, that he went out to his brethren, and he looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren." Now Moses had been raised as an Egyptian, but he knew he wasn't an Egyptian. He'd been raised as the prince, but he wasn't Pharaoh's grandson, in the literalist sense of this. And so one day when he's grown up, and maybe he's out flexing his prince muscles, he's looking over the kingdom. Here's what he sees. He sees the hard labor of the Israelites, and he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And you know what he does? Verse 12. You see, in just a casual reading of Scripture, sometimes you miss some of the subtleties. So he looked this way and that. He looked this way and that. Is anybody looking? No one was around. And he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't, oops. He looked this way, and then he looked that way, and he said, "Nobody's around." And then he buried him. As the news media would say today, in a shallow grave. And then he went out in verse 13 the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" But he said, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known." This time, he just talks to the Hebrews. When he finds two Hebrews that are having trouble getting along, and he says to those Hebrews, "Why are you fighting? You've got enough to worry about with this Egyptian bondage, and you've got enough to worry about how all this hard work's being put on you, and you've got enough to worry about." And they look at him, and they say, "You going to kill us too?" And so, Moses, in verse 14, "Surely the matter has become known." And in verse 15, "When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses had fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well." Well, that's the auspicious beginning of Moses. That's how it starts. There's a king that doesn't know Joseph, and Moses rises to be a prince by the imagination of his own family, but he ends up in a spot where he has to flee to live. And as he does this, because Pharaoh's going to kill him, he sits down by a well. And when he sits down by this well, it says, now the priest of Midian had seven daughters in verse 16, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to the water their father's flock. And the shepherds came down and drove them away, but Moses stood up and he helped them and he watered their flocks. And when you look at this, if you drop all the way down to the third chapter in verse 1, it says, now Moses was pasturing the flock of his father-in-law. And that's really where this is going to end in this first scenario of Moses' life. It doesn't seem to be all that exciting. There's a lot of stuff that happens. But he goes from being a prince to watching sheep. He goes from being a hero in Egypt to a hero of seven women because he drives away some people that are trying to steal their resources. But he ends up as somebody that's just an average person. No longer a prince. As a matter of fact, Pharaoh's going to spend the rest of his life wanting to kill him. And the only reason that that doesn't happen is Moses is younger than Pharaoh and Pharaoh dies. And if you're looking backwards here at this and you're going, how is it that Moses is such a great guy under the Old Testament? Because this doesn't seem like he's sitting by a well and he's watching sheep. Well, the story's not going to end there. But can you imagine the concept that Moses has in his mind here? There's got to be a reason that Moses did this. And you say, well, it doesn't sound to me like Moses was all that great a guy. And if you just look at the text in that regard, you may come to that conclusion. But let's go back to Hebrews 11 now. After we've done all this little groundwork here to get us to this point, here's what the Hebrew writer, if it be Paul, says in verse 24. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. You see, there was a reason he was out there walking around, looking at what was going on. He was the prince, but he wasn't looking at this from a perspective of being the prince of Egypt. He was looking for what was happening to the Hebrews. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Well, he didn't do that after he ran for his life. He gave up that position because of the fact that he knew that what was happening was not right, and he refused that prestigious title and went out and walked among the people. He chose to endure ill treatment with the people of God than enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. He's gotten himself kind of into a mess because he's killed somebody. But you would think that the power of Pharaoh could have gotten him out of that. But he wouldn't accept that. He fled. And then the text says, he considered the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking toward the reward. How in the world does Moses consider the reproach of Christ greater than the riches of Egypt? He didn't even know about Christ. But he knows that there's been a promise made. And he knows that through the seed of the Israelites will come one who will make all nations one through a Savior that will grant them eternal life, where the people won't be slaves, they'll be priests, where the people will have the hope of a better life than the pleasures of sin. And somehow, Moses had the fortitude of mind to say, God's promised this and it's coming, but I'm not going to find it in Egypt. And it looks for a moment like he gives up. He goes and he sits at a well, he helps some ladies, and then he starts tending sheep. And if that's where the story ended, it would be rather a sad story. They'd gone to such great lengths to bring him to this place. And now he's going to be the original sheep counter. He's going to be the one that just makes sure there's enough water and enough to eat. But God hears the cry of the Israelites, of the Hebrews, of his children as they are in bondage. And he remembers the covenant that he's made with them in Exodus, the third chapter. And he remembers Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And it's not that he forgot them. It's just that the cry of the people comes before him and God says, let's go get them. Let's go. Yeah. There's a fella that's familiar with the territory. He knows what it's like to be an Egyptian. He knows how the king lives. He knows more than he even realizes he knows. And I'm going to go get him. And we're going to go get my people. And he's going to bring them out. He's been watching sheep lately. He's probably overqualified for that. But now he's going to go get my sheep. And together, we're going to bring them out. And oh, the together is not always pretty. But together, they bring them out. And tomorrow night, we begin to look at the delivery where God appears to Moses in a bush that burns, but it's not destroyed. And Moses says, I must see this. And out of the bush comes the words, Moses. I want you to think for just a minute. If you saw a burning bush and out of it came your name, would your response have been, here I am? I don't think so. But what Moses had already seen was enough to hear, here I am. And God says who he is. And Moses becomes afraid, not because he's afraid of God, but because of the fact that he is in the presence of the one that he's been looking for to lead him to Christ, to that hope, to that promise. And here the story gets exciting, because the first thing that Moses is going to do is say, I'm not qualified to do this. And God says, that's okay. But Moses tries to prove how unqualified he is for the job. So here's the conclusion that we're coming to tonight. No matter where you are, if you're sitting by the well, if you're watching sheep, it might just be one day that changes the totality of your life, that you've got something now to do for the Lord. Moses told God why he couldn't do what God wanted him to do. And God said, this is why you can do what I'm telling you to do. Somewhere in your Bible, write this down. Quit telling God that you can't do what God's told you to do. Somewhere along the line, you've got to stop that and say, if he told me to do it, and he is God, then I can do it. You know what happens in that four-generation thing? What happens in that four-generation thing is somewhere back here, there were people that were raised in the Lord's body that began to hear, we can't, we can't, we can't. And somewhere between generation one and generation four, somebody believed it. Quit telling God you can't. Moses tried it. Tomorrow night you're going to see it doesn't end up pretty. Moses actually ends up almost saying, if you're looking for somebody and you can't make up your mind who you want to choose, don't choose me. And the reason that's funny is because you've had that thought. The prince becomes a shepherd and now is getting ready to deliver a people that he never thought that he'd have to deliver.